Chapter 3. Day 1. Jared Kushner, at 36, prided himself on his ability to get along with older men. By the time of Donald Trump's inauguration, he had become the designated intermediary between his father-in-law and the establishment, such as it was, more moderate Republicans, corporate interests, the New York rich. Having a line to Kushner seemed to offer an alarmed elite a handle on a volatile situation. Several of his father-in-law's circle of confidants also confided in Kushner, often confiding their worries about their friend, the president-elect. "I give him good advice about what he needs to do, and for 3 hours the next day he does it and then goes hopelessly off script," complained one of them to Trump's son-in-law. Kushner, whose pose was to take things in and not give much back, said he understood the frustration. These powerful figures tried to convey a sense of real-world politics, which they all claimed to comprehend at some significantly higher threshold than the soon-to-be president. They were all concerned that Trump did not understand what he was up against, that there was simply not enough method to his madness. Each of these interlocutors provided Kushner with something of a tutorial on the limitations of presidential power, that Washington was as much designed to frustrate and undermine presidential power as to accommodate it. "Don't let him piss off the press. Don't let him piss off the Republican Party. Don't threaten congressmen because they will fuck you if you do. And most of all, don't let him piss off the intel community," said one national Republican figure to Kushner. "If you fuck with the intel community, they will figure out a way to get back at you, and you'll have 2 or 3 years of a Russia investigation, and every day something else will leak out." A vivid picture was painted for the preternaturally composed Kushner of spies and their power, of how secrets were passed out of the intelligence community to former members of the community, or to other allies in Congress, or even to persons in the executive branch, and then to the press. One of Kushner's now frequent wise men callers was Henry Kissinger. Kissinger, who had been a front-row witness when the bureaucracy and intelligence community revolted against Richard Nixon, outlined the kinds of mischief, and worse, that the new administration could face. "Deep state, the left-wing and right-wing notion of an intelligence network permanent government conspiracy, part of the Breitbart lexicon, became the Trump team term of art. He's poked the deep state bear." Names were put to this: John Brennan, the CIA director, James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, Susan Rice, the outgoing national security advisor, and Ben Rhodes, Rice's deputy and an Obama favorite. Movie scenarios were painted: a cabal of intelligence community myrmidons privy to all sorts of damning evidence of Trump's recklessness and dubious dealings would, with a strategic schedule of wounding, embarrassing, and distracting leaks, make it impossible for the Trump White House to govern. What Kushner was told, again and again, is that the president had to make amends. He had to reach out. He had to mollify. These were forces not to be trifled with, was said with utmost gravity. Throughout the campaign, and even more forcefully after the election, Trump had targeted the American intelligence community, the CIA, FBI, NSC, and altogether 17 separate intelligence agencies, as incompetent and mendacious. His message was on autopilot, said one aide. Among the various and plentiful Trump mixed messages at odds with conservative orthodoxy, this was a particularly juicy one. His case against American intelligence included its faulty information about weapons of mass destruction that preceded the Iraq War, a litany of Obama, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and other war-related intelligence failures, and more recently, but by no means least of all, intelligence leaks regarding his purported Russian relationships and subterfuges. Trump's criticism seemed to align him with the left in its half century of making a boogeyman of American intelligence agencies. But in quite some reversal, the liberals and the intelligence community were now aligned in their horror of Donald Trump. Much of the left which had resoundingly and scathingly rejected the intelligence community's unambiguous assessment of Edward Snowden as a betrayer of national secrets rather than a well-intentioned whistleblower, now suddenly embraced the intelligence community's authority in its suggestion of Trump's nefarious relationships with the Russians. Trump was dangerously out in the cold. Hence, Kushner thought, it was sensible to make a reach out to the CIA among the first orders of the new administration's business. Trump did not enjoy his own inauguration. He had hoped for a big blowout. Tom Barrack, the would-be showman, in addition to Michael Jackson's Neverland Ranch, he had bought Miramax Pictures from Disney with the actor Rob Lowe, may have declined the chief of staff job, but as part of his shadow involvement with his friend's White House, he stepped up to raise the money for the inaugural and to create an event that, seemingly quite at odds with the new president's character and with Steve Bannon's wish for a no-frills populist inauguration, he promised would have a soft sensuality and poetic cadence. But Trump, imploring friends to use their influence to nail some of the A-level stars who were snubbing the event, started to get angry and hurt that stars were determined to embarrass him. Bannon, a soothing voice, as well as a professional agitator, tried to argue the dialectical nature of what they had achieved without using the word dialectical. Because Trump's success was beyond measure, or certainly beyond all expectations, the media and the liberals had to justify their own failure, he explained to the new president. In the hours before the inauguration, the whole of Washington seemed to be holding its breath. On the evening before Trump was sworn in, Bob Corker, the Republican senator from Tennessee and the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, opened his remarks as the featured speaker at a gathering at the Jefferson Hotel with the existential question, "Where are things going?" He paused for a moment and then answered, as though from some deep well of bewilderment, "I have no idea." Later that evening, a concert at the Lincoln Memorial, part of an always awkward effort to import pop culture to Washington, ended up, absent any star power, with Trump himself taking the stage as the featured act, angrily insisting to aides that he could outdraw any star. Dissuaded by his staff from staying at the Trump International Hotel in Washington and regretting his decision, the president-elect woke up on inaugural morning complaining about the accommodations at Blair House, the official guest residence across the street from the White House. Too hot, bad water pressure, bad bed. His temper did not improve. Throughout the morning, he was visibly fighting with his wife, who seemed on the verge of tears, and would return to New York the next day. Almost every word he addressed to her was sharp and peremptory. Kellyanne Conway had taken up Melania Trump as a personal PR mission, promoting the new First Lady as a vital pillar of support for the president and a helpful voice in her own right, and was trying to convince Trump that she could have an important role in the White House. But in general, the Trump's relationship was one of those things nobody asked too many questions about, another mysterious variable in the presidential mood. At the ceremonial meeting of the soon-to-be new president and the soon-to-be old president at the White House, which took place just before they set off for the swearing-in ceremony, Trump believed the Obamas acted disdainfully, very arrogant, toward him and Melania. Instead of wearing a game face, going into the inaugural events, the president-elect wore what some around him had taken to calling his golf face. Angry and pissed off, shoulders hunched, arms swinging, brow furled, lips pursed. This had become the public Trump. Truculent Trump. An inauguration is supposed to be a love-in. The media gets a new and upbeat story. For the party faithful, happy times are here again. For the permanent government, the swamp, it's a chance to curry favor and seek new advantage. For the country, it's a coronation. But Bannon had three messages or themes he kept trying to reinforce with his boss. His presidency was going to be different as any since Andrew Jackson's. He was supplying the less-than-well-read president-elect with Jackson-related books and quotes. They knew who their enemies were and shouldn't fall into the trap of trying to make them their friends, because they wouldn't be. And so, from day one, they should consider themselves on a war footing. While this spoke to Trump's combative counterpuncher side, it was hard on his eager-to-be-liked side. Bannon saw himself as managing these two impulses, emphasizing the former and explaining to his boss why having enemies here created friends somewhere else. In fact, Trump's aggrieved mood became a perfect match for the Bannon-written aggrieved inaugural address. Much of the 16-minute speech was part of Bannon's daily joie de guerre patter, his take back the country, America first, carnage everywhere vision for the country. But it actually became darker and more forceful when filtered through Trump's disappointment and delivered with his golf face. The administration purposely began on a tone of menace, a Bannon-driven message to the other side that the country was about to undergo profound change. Trump's wounded feelings, his sense of being shunned and unloved on the very day he became president, helped send that message. When he came off the podium after delivering his address, he kept repeating, "Nobody will forget this speech." George W. Bush, on the dais, supplied what seemed likely to become the historic footnote to the Trump address. "That's some weird shit." Trump, despite his disappointment at Washington's failure to properly greet and celebrate him, was, like a good salesman, an optimist. Salesmen, whose primary characteristic and main asset is their ability to keep selling, constantly recast the world in positive terms. Discouragement for everyone else is merely the need to improve reality for them. By the next morning, Trump was soliciting affirmation of his view that the inauguration had been a great success. That crowd went all the way back. That were more than 1 million people at least, right? He made a series of phone calls to friends who largely yesed him on this. Kushner confirmed a big crowd. Conway did nothing to dissuade him. Priebus agreed. Bannon made a joke. Among Trump's first moves as president was to have a series of inspirational photographs in the West Wing replaced with images of big crowd scenes at his inaugural ceremony. Bannon had come to rationalize Trump's reality distortions, Trump's hyperbole, exaggerations, flights of fancy, improvisations, and general freedom toward and mangling of the facts were products of the basic lack of guile, pretense, and impulse control that helped create the immediacy and spontaneity that was so successful with so many on the stump, while so horrifying to so many others. For Bannon, Obama was the North Star of aloofness. "Politics," said Bannon, with an authority that belied the fact that until the previous August he had never worked in politics, "is a more immediate game than he ever played it." Trump was, for Bannon, a modern-day William Jennings Bryan. Bannon had long talked about the need for a new William Jennings Bryan in right-wing politics, with friends assuming Bannon meant himself. At the turn of the 20th century, Bryan had enthralled rural audiences with his ability to speak passionately and extemporaneously for apparently unlimited periods of time. Trump compensated, in the theory of some intimates, including Bannon, for his difficulties with reading, writing, and close focus, with an improvisational style that produced, if not exactly a William Jennings Bryan effect, certainly close to the exact opposite of the Obama effect. It was part hortatory, part personal testimony, part barstool blowhard, a rambling, disjointed, digressive, what-me-worry approach that combined aspects of cable television rage, big tent religious revivalism, borscht belt Tumblr, motivational speaking, and YouTube vlogging. Charisma in American politics had come to define an order of charm, wit, and style, a coolness. But another sort of American charisma was more in the Christian evangelical vein, an emotional, experiential spectacle. The Trump campaign had built its central strategy around great rallies, regularly attracting tens of thousands, a political phenomenon that the Democrats both failed to heed and saw as a sign of Trump's limited appeal. For the Trump team, this style, this unmediated connection, his speeches, his tweets, his spontaneous phone calls to radio and television shows, and often to anyone who would listen, was revelatory, a new personal and inspirational politics. For the other side, it was clownishness that, at best, aspired to the kind of raw authoritarian demagoguery that had long been discredited by and assigned to history, and that, when it appeared in American politics, reliably failed. While the advantages of this style for the Trump team were now very clear, the problem was that it often, in fact regularly, produced assertions that were not remotely true. This had led increasingly to the two different realities theory of Trump politics. In the one reality, which encompassed most of Trump's supporters, his nature was understood and appreciated. He was the anti-wonk. He was the counter-expert. His was the gut call. He was the everyman. He was jazz. Some, in the telling, made it rap. Everybody else, an earnest folk music. In the other reality, in which resided most of his antagonists, his virtues were grievous, if not mental and criminal flaws. In this reality lived the media, which, with its conclusion of a misbegotten and bastard presidency, believed it could diminish him and wound him and wind him up and rob him of all credibility by relentlessly pointing out how literally wrong he was. The media, adopting a shocked morality, could not fathom how being factually wrong was not an absolute ending in itself. How could this not utterly shame him? How could his staff defend him? The facts were the facts. Defying them or ignoring them or subverting them made you a liar, intending to deceive, bearing false witness. A minor journalism controversy broke out about whether these untruths should be called inaccuracies or lies. In Bannon's view, one, Trump was never going to change. Two, trying to get him to change would surely cramp his style. Three, it didn't matter to Trump's supporters. Four, the media wasn't going to like him anyway. Five, it was better to play against the media than to the media. Six, the media's claim to be the protector of factual probity and accuracy was itself a sham. Seven, the Trump revolution was an attack on conventional assumptions and expertise. So better to embrace Trump's behavior than try to curb it or cure it. The problem was that, for all he was never going to stick to a script, his mind just doesn't work that way, was one of the internal rationalizations, Trump craved media approval. But, as Bannon emphasized, he was never going to get the facts right, nor was he ever going to acknowledge that he got them wrong, so therefore he was not going to get that approval. This meant, next best thing, that he had to be aggressively defended against the media's disapproval. The problem here was that the more vociferous the defense, mostly of assertions that could easily be proved wrong, the more the media redoubled its attacks and censure. What's more, Trump was receiving the censure of his friends, too. And it was not only calls from friends worried about him, but staffers calling people to call him and say, "Simmer down. Who do you have in there?" said Joe Scarborough in a frantic call. "Who's the person you trust? Jared? Who can talk you through this stuff before you decided to act on it?" "Well," said the president, "you won't like the answer, but the answer is me. Me. I talk to myself." Hence, within 24 hours of the inauguration, the president had invented a million or so people who did not exist. He sent his new press secretary, Sean Spicer, whose personal mantra would shortly become, "You can't make this shit up," to argue his case in a media moment that turned Spicer, quite a buttoned-down political professional, into a national joke, which he seemed destined to never recover from. To boot, the president blamed Spicer for not making the million phantom souls seem real. It was the first presidential instance of what the campaign regulars had learned over many months. On the most basic level, Trump just did not, as Spicer later put it, give a fuck. You could tell him whatever you wanted, but he knew what he knew. And if what you said contradicted what he knew, he simply didn't believe you. The next day, Kellyanne Conway, her aggressive posture during the campaign, turning more and more to petulance and self-pity, asserted the new president's right to claim alternative facts. As it happened, Conway meant to say alternative information, which at least would imply there might be additional data. But as uttered, it certainly sounded like the new administration was claiming the right to recast reality, which in a sense it was. Although in Conway's view, it was the media doing the recasting, making a mountain, hence fake news, out of a molehill, an honest minor exaggeration, albeit of vast proportions. Anyway, the frequently asked question about whether Trump would continue his unsupervised and often inexplicable tweets now that he was officially in the White House and the President of the United States, a question as hotly asked inside the White House as out, was answered. He would. This was his fundamental innovation in governing. Regular, uncontrolled bursts of anger and spleen. The president's immediate official business, however, was to make nice with the CIA. On Saturday, January 21st, in an event organized by Kushner, the president, in his first presidential act, paid a call on Langley to, in Bannon's hopeful description, play some politics. In carefully prepared remarks in his first act as president, he would lay some of the famous Trump flattery on the CIA and the rest of the sprawling and leaking U.S. intelligence world. Not taking off his dark overcoat, lending him quite a hulking gangster look, pacing in front of the CIA's wall of stars for its fallen agents, in front of a crowd of about 300 agency personnel and a group of White House staffers, and suddenly in a mood of sleepless cockiness and pleasure at having a captive crowd, the new president, disregarding his text, launched into what we could confidently call some of the most peculiar remarks ever delivered by an American president. "I know a lot about West Point. I'm a person who very strongly believes in academics. Every time I say I had an uncle who was a great professor at MIT for 35 years, who did a fantastic job in so many ways academically, he was an academic genius, and then they say, 'Is Donald Trump an intellectual?' Trust me, I'm like a smart person." Which was all somehow by way of praise for the new, soon-to-be-confirmed CIA director, Mike Pompeo, who had attended West Point and who Trump had brought with him to stand in the crowd, and who now found himself as bewildered as everyone else. "You know, when I was young, of course, I feel young. I feel like I was 30, 35, 39. Somebody said, 'Are you young?' I said, 'I think I'm young.' I was stopping in the final months of the campaign. 4 stops, 5 stops, 7 stops. Speeches in front of 25, 30,000 people. 15, 19,000. I feel young. I think we're all so young. When I was young, we were always winning things in this country. We'd win with trade. We'd win with wars. At a certain age, I remember hearing from one of my instructors, 'The United States has never lost a war.' And then after that, it's like we haven't won anything. You know the old expression, 'To the victor belongs the spoils.' You remember, I always say, 'Keep the oil.'" "Who should keep the oil?" asked a bewildered CIA employee, leaning over to a colleague in the back of the room. "I wasn't a fan of Iraq. I didn't want to go into Iraq, but I will tell you, when we were in, we got out wrong. And I always said, in addition to that, keep the oil. Now, I said it for economic reasons, but if you think about it, Mike," he called out across the room, addressing the soon-to-be director, "if we kept the oil, we wouldn't have ISIS, because that's where they made their money in the first place. So that's why we should have kept the oil. But okay, maybe you'll have another chance. But the fact is, we should have kept the oil." The president paused and smiled with evident satisfaction. "The reason you were my first stop, as you know, I have a running war with the media. They are among the most dishonest human beings on earth. And they sort of made it sound like I had a feud with the intelligence community. And I just want to let you know the reason you're the number one stop is exactly the opposite. Exactly. And they understand that. I was explaining about the numbers. We did a thing yesterday at the speech. Did everybody like the speech? You had to like it. But we had a massive field of people. You saw them. Packed. I get up this morning. I turn on one of the networks. And they show an empty field. And I say, 'Wait a minute. I made a speech. I looked out. The field was It looked like a million and a half people. They showed a field where there were practically nobody standing there. And they said Donald Trump did not draw well, and I said it was almost raining. The rain should have scared them away, but God looked down and said, "We're not going to let it rain on your speech." And in fact, when I first started, I said, "Ooh, no, first line, I got hit by a couple of drops." And I said, "Ooh, this is too bad, but we'll go right through it." The truth is, it stopped immediately. "No, it didn't," one of the staffers traveling with him said reflexively, then catching herself and, with a worried look, glancing around to see if she had been overheard. And then it became really sunny, and I walked off, and it poured right after I left. It poured, but we have something amazing because, honestly, it looked like a million and a half people. Whatever it was, it was. But it went all the way back to the Washington Monument, and by mistake, I get this network, and it showed an empty field, and it said we drew 250,000 people. Now, that's not bad, but it's a lie. And we had another one yesterday, which was interesting. In the Oval Office, there's a beautiful statue of Dr. Martin Luther King. And I also happen to like Churchill, Winston Churchill. I think most of us like Churchill. Doesn't come from our country, but had a lot to do with it. Helped us. Real ally. And as you know, the Churchill statue was taken out. So a reporter for Time magazine, and I have been on the cover like 14 or 15 times. I think I have the all-time record in the history of Time magazine. Like, if Tom Brady is on the cover, it's one time because he won the Super Bowl or something. I've been on 15 times this year. I don't think, Mike, that's a record that can ever be broken. You agree with that? What do you think?
"No," said Pompeo in a stricken voice.
But I will say that they said it was very interesting that Donald Trump took down the bust, the statue of Dr. Martin Luther King, and it was right there. There was a cameraman that was in front of it. So Zeke from Time magazine writes a story that I took it down. I would never do that. I have great respect for Dr. Martin Luther King, but this is how dishonest the media is. Now, big story, but the retraction was like this. He indicated ever so small with his fingers. Is it a line or do they even bother putting it in? I only like to say, I love honesty. I like honest reporting. I will tell you final time, although I will say it when you let in your thousands of other people who have been trying to come in because I'm coming back, we may have to get you a larger room, and we may have to get you a larger room, and maybe it will be built by somebody that knows how to build, and we won't have columns. You understand that? We get rid of the columns, but, you know, I just wanted to say that I love you. I respect you. There's nobody I respect more. You do a fantastic job, and we're going to start winning again. And you're going to be leading the charge, so thank you all very much. In a continuing sign of Trump's Rashomon effect, his speeches inspiring joy or horror, witnesses would describe his reception at the CIA as either a Beatles-like emotional outpouring or a response so confounded and appalled that, in the seconds after he finished, you could hear a pin drop.